base and its computer files intact if possible. Of course, it remained to be seen whether or not they'd agreed in good faith, and if Casey's proposed tactic for dealing with the missile platforms didn't work, the whole question would probably be moot anyway. Those platforms weren't especially well protected, but they mounted a lot of launchers. If they had the ability to manage that many missiles simultaneously, they were going to be dangerous as hell in a missile engagement. In fact, at that sort of range, the two of them were probably worth at least another battlecruiser, maybe even two. Clegg's approval of Travis's idea for dealing with them had been another surprise. The fact that she'd given him credit even while officially putting her own neck on the line was also more than he had expected. For his part, Basaltberg had been quick to come on board with the tactic, as well as with Clegg's own suggested psychological warfare flourish to encourage the mercenaries' mobile units to stand and fight. "Lieutenant Lukanov," Clegg said abruptly into the tense silence.
"Yes, ma'am,"
the astrogator replied.
"It's time," the captain said, her voice glacially calm. "Take us into hyper."
HMS Casey blasted into normal space just outside the Walther system hyper limit, in a bleeding cascade of transit energy. They had arrived just under 272 million kilometers from Walther Prime, Travis noted from his board, and within 7,000 kilometers of Clegg's designated locus. And all on a 10-light-minute micro-jump.
"Impressive job, Ms. Lukanov," Clegg said. "Tell me how we line up."
"Yes, ma'am,"
Lukanov said, tapping rapidly on her keyboard.
"If we accelerate at 200 gravities for 367 seconds, we can drop back and be right on profile."
"Very good," Clegg said. "Commander Woodburn, take us in." Unlike Casey's first visit to Walther, this time she would make no effort to conceal her presence. She aimed at the point in space where Walther Prime would be in 6 hours and 42 minutes and ran Lukanov's specified numbers. Then, with the ship now exactly on her carefully planned profile, she reduced her acceleration to 190G and bored straight in. Travis sat back in front of his own panel, feeling the long hours that now stretched ahead of him. Against all doubts, his own as well as, he suspected, Lady Calvingdell's, he and Chomps had actually pulled it off. With the backing of Delphi, Delphi's training and equipment, a lot of hard work, and probably more than a little luck, they'd tracked Manticore's attacker to his lair. And yet, despite the satisfaction of that accomplishment, and despite Chomps's assertion that Travis was a born spy, he was slowly coming to realize that the tactical officer's chair was where he felt most comfortable, sitting here, preparing to put himself, the men and women under his command, and his ship between his Star Kingdom and her enemies, was where he needed to be. Even more, it was where he wanted to be. That wasn't where he thought he would end up when he first enlisted. The Navy had been an escape, both from the desolate wasteland of his life and from the more immediate threat of jail if he'd been incriminated in the robbery he hadn't known was about to occur. It had offered him a haven, a refuge, and he'd grabbed it with both hands. In time, he'd discovered he was good at it, but in so many ways, it had still been just a job. Yet, even before the Battle of Manticore that had begun to change, slowly, so slowly that he hadn't even noticed it until now, the concept of a job or even a career had turned into a calling. Somewhere in those years he'd realized, only subconsciously at first, that there were people and principles he would die to protect. He had no idea when that had happened, but it was where he stood now, though he would probably be too embarrassed and self-conscious to ever admit it out loud to anyone, except possibly Lisa. He thought he was searching for rules and structure. Instead, what he'd really been searching for were clarity and purpose. Ahead in the distance were 18 warships belonging to a mercenary fleet which had already attacked his home once. Whatever else happened, he thought darkly, these particular ships would never do that again. There was really no way, Jensen knew, that 8 warships and a freighter translating into the Danic system in tight sequence could be seen as anything but someone's military. Fortunately, that was precisely the role the Volsungs were trying to play in the first place. Not that he'd mind if the Danic authorities were just a little nervous. Lin had said the Volsungs would be on the hook for the launcher's installation,
and long experience had shown Jensen that nervous people were less likely to price gouge their customers. Of course, in this case, there was an additional reason not to worry about Daniken anxiety. He was supposed to be an admiral of the Andermani Navy, and Emperor Gustav's people didn't spend their time worrying about other people's tender sensibilities. He scowled at the displays. The formation had come in tight, but their translation locus was almost 21 light seconds off, putting them better than 10 light minutes short of their most probable destination on a least time course. A genuine Andermani captain would probably ream someone out for that. Once they were underway, he would see about doing precisely that.
"Spin up our transponders," he ordered Captain Imbar. "Andermani warships always respect the niceties of interstellar law. Just make sure we're showing the right ones."
10 minutes later, the reply came.
"Andermani ship Winterfeld, this is Danek Traffic Control," a voice said from the bridge speaker. "Welcome to Danek. We've been expecting you. Jarier Operations Manager Dostoevsky sends her greetings, and Secretary of Industry Charnay has been asked to relay President Nelson's welcome as well."
Jensen leaned back in his chair, gripping the armrest tightly with satisfaction and released tension. So Lin's man Keturah had made it to Haven and back with the necessary paperwork. Perfect. He allowed himself a few seconds to gloat, then pressed the comm stud.
"Thank you, Traffic Control," he replied, giving free rein to the Andermani accent he'd spent years getting rid of. "This is Admiral Koenig of the Imperial Andermani Navy. I assume from your greeting that you know why we're here?"
He leaned back, busying himself with status reports and fine-tuning the Volsung formation as he waited out the 20-minute round-trip communications lag.
"We do indeed, Admiral." DTC's voice came right on schedule. "We've been instructed to inform you that Master Robotham's authorization for the work on your ships has been approved by the Jurier office in Nouveau-Paris. We only learned about the work order a day ago, but we've done some shuffling, and I think we'll be able to fit you in as expeditiously as Master Robotham's requested."
"Andermani ship Winterfeld, this is Danek Traffic Control. Welcome to Danek. We've been expecting you."
"Here we go," Captain Marcello murmured.
Lisa nodded, gazing at the navigation display as she listened to the cheerful greeting. On the display, more or less exactly where Commodore Charnay had predicted, a cluster of icons labeled Swenson 1 had just appeared. She checked the boards, doing a quick calculation. DTC's message had been transmitted simultaneously just over 13 minutes ago, both to the newly arrived pirate fleet and to the Allied squadron. That meant Swenson 1 had received it 213 seconds earlier and undoubtedly replied by now. Presumably, Swenson's response had already been relayed to Santange by DTC, but she and Damocles wouldn't know about that for at least another 9 minutes.
"I suppose it's a good thing we got here with 2 days to spare," Marcello added.
"Beg your pardon, sir?" Lisa asked.
"Sorry, talking to myself," Marcello apologized. "I was just thinking that it's lucky we got here with 2 days to spare. If we hadn't, the Danikins would still be dragging their feet."
Lisa nodded wearily.
"Yes, sir. That they would."
Nobody had told the Danikin government that its star system was about to be turned into a battlefield, and System President Nelson's response to Commodore Charnay's news had been far less than happy. And extremely less than cooperative. Danek's population was still extremely small, most of it centered on Danek Alpha, the larger of the system's twin planets. At any given moment, though, at least a third of that population was distributed out in Bergen's Ring, an asteroid belt notable for its density and rich resources, its relatively short transit distance to Alpha, and the fact that it lay well inside the system's hyperlimit. That meant the limit was a less than optimally long haul from the shipyard and mineral extraction platforms the Jurier Consortium was busily building. But at the same time, it also offered a certain degree of military security, since any potential attacker had at least a 4-hour transit time, even at 200 gravities acceleration. For a 0-0 solution, that went up to over 5 hours, which, in theory at least, should give a defender time to respond. It also gave time for the civilians in an invader's path to refugee out. Quite a few of them, Lisa noted, had done exactly that over the past 18 hours. The Zhurye shipyards and orbital mining facilities were the real reason for the system's development. Major concentrations of manufacturing, shipbuilding, and repair platforms would eventually be established in 12 equidistant nodal positions around the ring. But at the moment, only two were fully operational. A third was in the process of spinning up, however, and the initial HAB module for a fourth had just been brought online. Danek was on its way to being one of the galaxy's success stories, which probably explained President Nelson's lack of enthusiasm at the prospect of entertaining such energetic visitors. In fact, for almost 24 hours, she'd flatly refused to go along. Her initial response had been to instruct Danek Traffic Control that Swenson was to be informed that he was not welcome, that Danek contained no missiles or upgraded launchers for his ships, and that a Havenite squadron was prepared to open fire upon him if he violated the system hyperlimit. The thought of what might happen to the Baird family had clearly weighed upon her, but her overriding responsibility was to the citizens of her own star system, not to the family of a Solarian merchant. For some reason, no one in the Republic of Haven, or aboard HMS Damocles, had considered the possibility of such a thoroughly rational attitude on the Danican government's part. Obviously, they should have, and changing Nelson's mind had required all the persuasiveness Commodore Charnay, Captain Katura, and Zhurye representative Weissman could bring to bear. It must have been an interesting discussion, Lisa thought. From all accounts, President Nelson was a stubborn woman, and she'd had a lot of good reasons on her side. The decisive point had probably been Charnay's argument that it was in everyone's interests to take a pirate force this powerful out of play. His appeal to the collective security treaty between the Republic and Danek had played its part as well, although Lisa suspected Weissman's position as the Home Office representative of what was Danek's major employer and an official member of the Republic's government had played a rather larger role than any sense of interstellar obligation on Nelson's part. As for Katura, after recounting Max Baird's desperate situation to the president, he'd left it to Weissman and Charnay to convince her to go along, while he took Pacemaker to the gas refinery complex and refueling station orbiting Hellier, Danek's innermost gas giant. It wasn't an unreasonable request. After all the high-speed running around he'd done, his ship had needed reactor mass badly. Still, Lisa wondered if his prime motivation had been to get away from the discussion. He'd made his personal anguish over the Baird family situation clear enough, and sitting on the sidelines while it was all hashed out yet again couldn't have been easy on him. In the end, however, President Nelson had agreed that Traffic Control would cooperate in Operation Ambuscade. If Ambuscade worked as designed, no one would be firing off missiles anywhere near important system infrastructure. That had been another factor in Nelson's decision to cooperate, but she'd flatly refused to commit any of the Danek System Navy's handful of lightly armed corvettes to the battle. Instead, she'd ordered her naval commander to hold them in a covering position for Danek Alpha. If anyone was getting killed in the Danek system, she clearly intended for the casualties to be incurred by the people who'd brought this trouble to her citizens in the first place. Lisa Donnelly understood Nelson's attitude, but that hadn't made her any happier about it.
"I guess the important thing is that Nelson came on board in the end," she said.
"Agreed," Marcello said. "I wish Massengill and her people had had a little longer to get settled in at three, though. Still, she seems confident that everything's in place."
Lisa hissed softly between her teeth.
"I hope she's right, sir."
"Yes, so do I."
"Master Robotham had hoped Zhurye could accommodate you at Bergen 1," Danek Traffic Control said. "But I'm afraid they're swamped right now. They can't clear any of their slips for at least a T week, possibly two. It's our understanding your Navy needs this upgrade expedited, correct?"
Jensen ground his teeth. Of course he wanted it expedited. But what was this about not being able to clear any slips for at least a week? Some last-minute play of Lin's? He forced back the reflexive flicker of suspicion. He was in control here, and Lin knew it.
"Correct," he confirmed. "So what exactly are you saying? That Zhurye can't accommodate us?"
"Oh no, Admiral. Zhurye can certainly accommodate you," Traffic Control said after another 20 minutes lag. "They just can't take your ships at Bergen 1. Most of the heavy work is going to have to be done at Bergen 2 instead."
Unfortunately, 2 is still in its expansion phase, and its capacity is considerably lower than 1's. But all that means is that they'll only be able to handle 4 of your ships at a time, or only 3 if the first round includes both of your battlecruisers. However, Gerier understands your need to expedite, and so they've arranged to undertake some of the preliminary work at Bergen 3. They can't install the full suite of systems you require there, but they can strip out the old systems and offload your old ordnance, which would get that part of the installation out of the way. Secretary Charnay and Ms. Dostoevsky have run the numbers and concluded that if you send 1 battlecruiser and 1 heavy cruiser to 3, it would ultimately cut the time for your second set of refits at least in half.
Jensen frowned as he studied his navigation plot, where astrogation had brought up the icons of the new destinations. It wasn't as bad as it could have been, but it was bad enough. Bergen 2 and Bergen 3 were on almost opposite sides of the primary. Bergen 3 laying roughly 16.2 LM to port of Odin's current vector. Bergen 2 laying 23.27 LM off the Volsung's starboard bow, as the Volsungs continued heading for Bergen 1. He didn't like putting that much separation between his units, especially since he hadn't planned on splitting them up at all. On top of that, he knew how local governments and shipyards functioned out here, especially with someone they expected to be a one-time visitor. One of their favorite ploys was to surreptitiously damage or incapacitate critical systems, and then charge through the ceiling to fix the damage their techs had fortuitously discovered. It would take a lot of nerve to try to gouge an Andromani fleet that way, but the Empire was a long way from Danic, and the locals might just think they could take even Uncle Gustav's money and run. He swiveled toward the comm screen he had tied to Banshee's bridge.
You heard?
Of course, Lynn said. Doesn't sound all that unreasonable to me.
Yeah, well, you're not the one being told to split up his fleet, Jensen growled. Who's this Secretary of Industry Charnay, anyway? One of the people you're going to have to bribe?
I told you there was no way to be sure who it would be, Lynn said with clearly strained patience. The last time I was here, the Secretary of Industry was a woman named Bradshaw, but that was a long time ago. According to my records, though, there was a Charnay. I don't have a first name, as an undersecretary in that department. He dropped his gaze to something off-screen. He's apparently a trained engineer with a strong background in shipbuilding. He looked up again. Does sound like he's our guy.
I'm not real fond of sounds like, Jensen said warningly.
Don't worry about it, Lynn advised. Remember what he said about relaying the president's welcome? That's the kind of thing someone says when they want a face-to-face.
A quiet face-to-face. So that they can collect their credit chip?
Exactly. Jensen frowned. Still, the analysis sounded reasonable. Of course, it didn't say anything one way or the other about the locals' possible avarice. On the other hand, if he played his cards right, he might have a way to find out before they got their hands too deeply into his pockets.
I would prefer to continue to keep both my battlecruisers together and under my supervision while the work is being carried out, he said into the calm microphone. However, Ms. Dostoevsky's suggestion for expediting the prep work sounds reasonable. Therefore, I propose.
Lynn's computer pinged. Listening with half an ear to Jensen's response to DTC, he checked the display. His slightly out-of-date records indicated that Adelaide Bradshaw was still Secretary of Industry in the Danic System government. There was no mention of an undersecretary named Charnay. But the records did list a Captain Gustav Charnay of the Republic of Haven Navy. He huffed out a silent sigh of relief. He'd known that Keturah had come through the minute traffic control greeted Winterfeld as an expected arrival. Now, if the Charnay DTC had named was the same one as in his database, it would appear Haven had bought the kidnapping story and decided to respond with force. Whether they'd responded with sufficient force remained to be seen, but they probably wouldn't have come if they didn't think they had it under control. Though this ploy to split up Jensen's force didn't sound promising, if they needed to divide the Volsungs into more bite-sized pieces.
Sir? Ramus's voice murmured from the intercom. We have a burst transmission from Pacemaker.
Lynn peered at the plot and the carrot marking the transmission sender. The ship showed no ID code, but it was well to port of the Volsung's current vector, about 2 minutes inside the hyperlimit on a heading for Danik Alpha from the vicinity of Hellier. Or rather, it had been heading for Danik Alpha. Now, suddenly, the ship had stopped accelerating and was actively decelerating, obviously hoping to stay clear of any possible confrontation. It also meant that, assuming the diversion to Bergen 2 worked and Pacemaker held her current heading, Keturah was going to land in almost exactly the right spot to complete his part of the operation. Things could still go south in a major way, of course, but between Keturah's smooth competence and Jensen's obsessive punctuality, all the pieces on the board seemed to be where Lynn wanted them. Hopefully, Haven had sent along enough firepower to take care of the Volsungs once and for all. If not, Lynn himself would be able to make sure that whatever Jensen knew about Axelrod and its interest in Manticore, that information would go no further.
"Decrypt?" he asked Ramos.
"Coming through now, sir,"
Banshee's captain said, and fresh text appeared on Lynn's display. Even transmitting over a relatively short distance and from well to one side of the Volsung formation, there was always the chance that a burst transmission over a tightly focused comm laser might find unintended ears. But Keturah knew that, and had chosen an encryption similar to the ones the Jurier Consortium used for their own internal communications. Anyone who noticed it would probably assume it was routine traffic.
Havenite force under Commodore Gustav Charnay. 1 BC, 3 CAs, 5 DDs, 1 FG. Also attached 1 Manticoran DD.
So Charnay had been promoted to Commodore since Lynn's last file update. Not really surprising. What was surprising was that the Havenite force had a Manticoran destroyer in the mix. Lynn scowled. And if there was one RMN ship, were there others? Maybe even a whole fleet that Keturah didn't know about? Probably not. Still, it was a possibility Lynn couldn't reject out of hand. Jensen's after-action report had indicated that the RMN he'd left behind had been considerably more mauled than the RMN that Lynn had encountered a couple of weeks later. He'd downplayed that discrepancy in his conversations with the Volsung Admiral, but it was a puzzle he hadn't yet sorted out. Lynn had detected 5 battle cruisers. Jensen had insisted he'd left behind only 3. That meant 2 of them must have been visitors. Almost certainly Havenite, no matter what their transponders had said. So far, that was the best sense he'd been able to make of the puzzle. Still, it fit with the Republic's efforts to establish a collective security arrangement in what was coming to be known as the Haven Quadrant. Granted, their presence at that particular time had been annoyingly fortuitous, and there was still the matter of the Manticoran transponder codes. Still, what mattered was that Manticore surely wouldn't have risked sending any of its own heavy ships away from the home system when they had no way of telling when their attackers might return. Detaching 1 or 2 lighter units for joint operations with Haven, on the other hand, made a great deal of sense. In a way, that was too bad. Lynn would have preferred Haven to have a crushing force advantage, and a horde of Manticoran ships supporting them would have been a welcome addition. On the other hand, the presence of an unexpected Manticoran ship could prove problematic. Jensen had disguised himself a bit, at Lynn's insistence, but it was a quick and rudimentary disguise, not nearly up to Lynn's own standards. A sharp-eyed Manticoran might be able to see past the Prussian-style mustache and prominent cheek scar, and a sharp-eared one might recognize the voice of the man who'd invaded their space and called for their king's surrender. If that happened, the Manticorans might be able to persuade the Havenites to offer Jensen his life in exchange for information. Fortunately, thanks to Hester, Lynn still held the whole card.
"Sir, Imbar is signaling the rest of the Volsung force," Ramos reported. "He's warning them to keep a close eye on us and be ready in case we make a run for it. Apparently Jensen doesn't trust us."
"I'm so very disappointed. Any replies?"
"Copperhead and Fommelhaut report they each have their laser manned and a missile prepped for launch," Ramos replied. "Imbar's warning them not to paint us with active targeting, lest Danik wonder why they're targeting their own freighter. Fommelhaut is offended that Imbar feels the need to point out the obvious. Copperhead seconds that opinion, but with more profanity.
Lynn smiled, and Hester probably still thought all of the little jobs he'd given her over the past few months, such as hacking Jensen's comm encryptions, had been just busy work.
I think we can trust them to hold their fire, at least for now, he told Ramos.
He looked at the master plot, watching as vectors and projected arrival times began to shift.
It looks like about 3.5 hours until Exodus.
Yes, sir, Ramos said. I'll be sorry to see her go.
You'll get over it, Lynn assured him. And don't worry, I'll get you an even shinier toy when this is done.
However, Ms. Dostoevsky's suggestion for expediting the prep work sounds reasonable.
The pirate admiral's voice came from Damocles' bridge speaker.
Therefore, I propose a compromise. My main body is altering course for Bergen II now, but I'll be detaching 3 of my cruisers, Molwitz, Burkersdorf, and Rossbach, to Bergen III. 3 heavy cruisers should be about the same workload as 1 battle cruiser and 1 heavy cruiser, and that would allow me to personally supervise Winterfeld and Boyen's refits.
Damn,
Marcello murmured, looking across at Lisa. Lisa nodded. She'd already pulled up the ship list Captain Keturah had provided, but she didn't really need it. Like her captain, she'd committed it to memory. And Molwitz, Burkersdorf, and Rossbach were more properly known as Adder, Copperhead, and Mamba, Swenson's 3 Thuban-class ships.
Well, that was unexpected, Marcello continued.
Lisa nodded again, wondering how Brigadier Massengill and her commandos were going to handle this one. Bergen III consisted of 2 active platforms, and 2 more still in the process of construction. Massengill's operations plan had divided her troops evenly between the operational platforms, under the assumption that she would face only 2 ships. 3 of them would not only spread her available combat power thinner on at least 1 platform, but it also offered a greater opportunity for the timing to go awry. Still, as Commodore Charnay had pointed out, if anyone could handle that situation, it would be Massengill and the 303rd. Heavy cruisers were also less likely than battle cruisers to have sizable ground combat components aboard, which should offset some of the Brigadier's dispersal problems.
I assume you heard that, Captain Marcello?
Charnay said from the captain's comm display.
Yes, sir, Marcello replied. Has DTC responded yet?
Unfortunately, there wasn't time for them to run it past us before they did, Charnay set out. They couldn't very well tell him no without a good reason. After all, on the face of it, it's a completely logical suggestion.
Wonderful, Marcello murmured.
Agreed, Charnay said. This is going to make things a lot trickier for the Brigadier. And unfortunately, she's not the only one whose timing it's likely to impact.
There they go,
Captain Imbar growled as the designated cruisers headed for Bergen III.
Von Belling and Michelson behaving like hot dogs as usual. Should I calm them to slow it down?
No, let them have their fun, Jensen said, eyeing the plot. Besides, everyone knows the Andermani do things better than anyone else in the galaxy. Let them show the Danakans how good they really are.
He didn't bother to add that the main reason he'd chosen them for detachment was that nobody else could keep up with them anyway. The Thubans were the fastest ships in the Volsung's inventory, with a 6 gravity maximum acceleration advantage over even Odin, and compensators that were equally robust. As a result, their captains routinely operated them at 85% power, rather than the more normal 80%, whenever they could cut loose from the rest of the fleet's apron strings. Given their primary role of defending the battlecruisers from missiles, that didn't happen very often, and they relished any opportunities that came their way. And so as Odin continued towards Bergen II at the formation's stately 185 gravities, Adder, Copperhead, and Mamba accelerated steadily away from them at 223 gravities.
Just make sure Von Belling and Schneider know they're not supposed to let any of Danik's techs on board until Michelson's had a chance to see how competent they are, Jensen added. I don't want the locals getting near anything critical until we're positive this isn't an attempt to hit us up for extra fees before they dock.
I doubt that's really necessary, Admiral, Lynn spoke up from the link to Banshee. You may be a one-time customer, but Master Robotham is local and does a fair amount of business in Danik.
You're also rather forgetting that you're units of the Andermani Navy, and no one wants to get blacklisted by Gustav Andermann. His personal disapproval aside, his word still carries a lot of weight with the Salarians.
Maybe, Jensen said curtly. But I'm not taking any chances. I'll be keeping my eye on things at Bergen, too. Von Belling and the others had damn well better do likewise.
That much faster, sir? Marcello asked.
That much faster, Charnay confirmed grimly.
Lisa winced as she punched numbers into her console. When they'd come up with the plan to divert some of Swenson's units, they'd assumed that one of the battlecruisers would have been included. Ideally, Swenson would have taken his flagship into the trap, enabling Massengill to capture him and decapitate his entire force. The more likely scenario, though, had been that he would detach Boyen, otherwise known as Loki, whose maximum safe acceleration was only 185G. At the moment, the three cruisers, now designated Swenson 2, had separated from the main formation. Swenson 1 had been 9.84 LM from her original destination at Bergen 1. That had put it 23.27 LM from Bergen 2 and 16.2 LM from Bergen 3. From that starting point, Loki would have been 7 hours and 2 minutes from a 0-0 with Bergen 3. But at the Thuban's higher acceleration, they were only 6 hours and 23 minutes away. That meant Swenson 2 would arrive 39 minutes earlier than Loki could. Which meant Massengill's attack might well have to begin over a half hour earlier than the plan had assumed. Even worse, the rest of the pirate fleet would be 39 minutes and a solid 4.9 million kilometers farther away and traveling 4,254 kps faster than Commodore Charnay's battle plan had allowed for. Lisa punched more numbers, studying them closely. Swenson 1 would still be too deep into the inner system to kill its velocity and accelerate back out short of engagement range. But if the balloon went up early at Bergen 3, and the rest of the bad guys were smart enough to cut and run the instant it did, it would probably make intercepting them more difficult. Depending on how much too soon it went up, it could make things very difficult indeed. On the other hand, the timing here had always been problematic. Even Loki would have reached Bergen 3 84 minutes before the rest of the fleet reached Bergen 2. The transmission lag between Bergen 3 and Bergen 2 was 15.8 minutes, which would have bought some of that time back. But that had still left an interval of well over an hour in which Loki might have warned her consorts they were headed into a trap. No one had been willing to assume that Massengill's people could take out two ships before at least one of them got a message off. Accordingly, they designed a carefully choreographed set of procedures intended to burn at least 40 to 50 minutes between Loki's arrival and her actual docking. That would have kicked off the boarding attempt only about 10 minutes before the rest of the pirates were at Commodore Charnay's desired range from Bergen 2, at which point any warning messages from either section of their forces would have crossed one another in transmission. That 39-minute difference was going to make the timing a lot trickier, but that was the reality. Lisa knew as she watched CIC project the pirates' newly diverging vectors onto Damocles' main plot. They would all just have to deal with it. And of course, right in the middle of Jensen's work on rethinking and reworking his schedule, Lin's face popped up on his comm display.
What do you want? Jensen growled. I'm busy, thanks to your helpful friends.
I understand, Lin said in one of those soothing tones he used when he wanted something or didn't think Jensen would understand some complicated plan he was going to pitch. And I don't want to add any extra complications to your life. I just wanted you to know that I've received a coded burst transmission.
Jensen sat up straighter.
What kind of transmission?
It's not a problem, Lin assured him hastily. Quite the contrary. It's merely confirmation that Secretary Charnay is, indeed, the one waiting for our credit ship.
Good. That particular concern had been pushed into the back of Jensen's mind by everything else, but it had never entirely left. So we're good to go?
Mostly, Lin said. It appears we'll also have to deal with a couple of yard foremen. Again, not a problem, but I'll need to figure out how much extra this is going to cost.
And why are you bothering me with this?
Because you need to be aware that there could be a brief delay when we reach the yard platforms while the arrangements are being made.
Really?
Jensen said, turning up the voltage in his stare.
Have I ever mentioned how much I dislike delays?
I'm not particularly fond of them either, Lin said with a scowl. Especially when my original instructions were crystal clear. Unfortunately, there doesn't seem to have been anything Katura could have done about it. We're going to need to discuss the foreman's demands, then authorize their payments, then find a way to slip the money into their accounts without Gerier bookkeepers noticing.
You're not making me any happier, Jensen warned.
Don't worry. It's nothing I haven't done dozens of times before, Lin assured him. But it's likely to keep me busy for the next few hours, and I wanted you to know why I'll be on the comm a lot, and therefore why I might not be instantly available if you need my help with something.
Jensen snorted, like he would need the little man's help at this point.
Fine, he said. You're the one signing the slips. Go see how many credits you have to fork over this time.
How many credits my employer has to fork over, you mean? Lin replied, and Jensen suppressed a smile at the irritation in the other's tone. Apparently, Lin didn't like being gouged any more than he did, even when it wasn't his own personal money.
Whatever, he said. Just make sure the details are settled before we're ready to dock. I want to get this show on the road.
Of course, Admiral, Lin assured him. As do I.
Damn,
Brigadier Jean Massengill muttered under her breath as she punched numbers and flung names back and forth across her tablet.
Damn, 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 and damn again.
The schedule had called for her to delay the pirate's incoming battlecruiser 40 to 50 minutes before getting her commandos aboard and launching their attack. Now they needed to drag that out another 30 to 40 minutes. The plan had called for two teams, one each for a battlecruiser and heavy cruiser. Now it was going to be three teams for three Thuban heavy cruisers. So not only did she need to find a way to tap dance for a full hour and a half, she also needed to split two teams into three, and those three teams needed to take a crash course in Thuban's architecture.
Brigadier?
Massengill looked up to see Major Elsie Dorman striding up to her, another tablet in her hand.
Yes?
I've pulled up specs for the Thubans, Dorman said. Everyone's looking them over, and Bastange and Danza are mapping out the routes and procedures.
Good, Massengill said. Major Bastange and Captain Danzer had been the leaders of the two 30-man teams who would have taken on the pirates. Only now, each of their teams would be reduced to 20. That was not a hell of a lot against a ship full of pirates.
At least they won't have to cut their way out of cargo containers this time,
Dorman reminded her. True, Massengill said, feeling a ghost of a smile at the memory of the Solway operation. That one had gone off without a hitch. But that one had had extensive planning ahead of time, and no last-minute surprises.
What about the teams? She asked. Have you and the others figured out how to split them up?
We've come up with two options, Dorman said, handing over her tablet. The first would leave Bastange's and Danzer's core groups intact. The downside is that would make the third team mostly made up of less experienced fighters.
Massengill scowled. With the bulk of the 303rd off on training exercises elsewhere in the Republic, these 60 men and women were all she'd been able to scrape together on the short notice she'd been given. They'd had a few days in transit to train together, but they were far from being fully coherent units.
The second would strip five commandos from each of the core groups to form the core of the third,
Dorman continued.
That would lower the experience level of groups one and two, but give three a more solid center.
Understood, Massengill said, studying the options. Do you have a recommendation on threes, Commander?
Dorman shrugged slightly.
The only logical choice is me.
Massengill suppressed a sigh. Yes, she'd pretty well seen that one coming. Only she didn't want it. Dorman was experienced, but she was older than the average 303rd, and therefore somewhat lower on the strength and stamina scales. Ironically, perhaps, that same age detriment, along with her gender, tended to make opponents underestimate her. That gave her a huge advantage in the ambush and subterfuge categories, which was why Massengill had set her up as one of the lower-level techs with Danzer's team. Getting close to the people in charge of critical systems was one of Dorman's specialties, and Massengill had hoped to take advantage of those skills. But she was right. Experience and leadership, not to mention her rank,
argued for Dorman commanding Group 3.
And your recommendation on the split?
Leave the other two groups their cause and give me the newbies, Dorman said without hesitation. As long as I have Rushkoff, I can make it work.
Massengill nodded. Rushkoff was one of their best-trained ship techs, and would probably be the first to get the Thuban details under his belt. On top of that, he had a gift of gab that enabled him to convince the most hardened skeptic that he knew exactly what he was talking about.
All right, she said, handing the tablet back. Get on it. I'll go corral the yard dogs and figure out how we're going to vamp for an extra half hour.
If all else fails, ma'am, Dorman offered, you could always start reminiscing about the good old days.
I'll keep that in mind, Major, Massengill said. Go prep your team.
Chapter 33
Commander? Lieutenant Wolfgang Meller, ATO of the Volsung battlecruiser Tarantel, called back across the bridge.
Something odd, sir.
Lieutenant Commander Marco Feynman, Tarantel's tactical officer, looked up from his novel, a trickle of hopeful interest rising in him. Duty at Walther Prime's Schmiede space station was about as cripplingly boring as anything the Volsung mercenaries had to offer, and anything that could lighten that uniformly gray lifescape would be welcome. Though probably it was nothing more than a twitchy reading on one of Tarantel's systems. Still, anything was better than nothing.
What is it, Meller? He asked.
We've just picked up an incoming impeller wedge, sir,
Meller replied, turning his head to look over his shoulder at Feynman.
I checked the schedule update from Schmiede, and we're not expecting anyone for at least 2 months.
I see.
Feynman bookmarked his page, unstrapped, and swam leisurely across the bridge to tactical. He grabbed one of the handholds on the back of Meller's chair and frowned past the younger man's shoulder at the icon gleaming on the tactical plot. There was a wedge there, all right, and it was heading inward, straight toward the Volsung station. Meller had already pulled up Captain Hauser's last two schedule updates on a different display. Feynman ran an eye over them, confirmed that there were no visitors expected, and looked back at the icon. Odd, certainly. Still, hardly a cause for panic. The mercenary business didn't run on a public transport system's schedule, after all. There could be any number of reasons a single ship, from the impeller signature, he tentatively identified it as either a destroyer or a cruiser, could be incoming to Walther. At the moment, though, he couldn't think of any reason that made sense. If everything had gone according to schedule, Admiral Jensen had only just now arrived at Danak. He couldn't possibly have gotten there, learned anything important enough to justify sending a courier back to Walther, and gotten the courier here by now. And it was highly unlikely that anyone else would be sending them couriers. So the odds were that whoever this was, it wasn't a Volsung. Which raised all sorts of interesting questions of its own.
Calm, he called over his shoulder. Raise Schmiede. Inform Captain Hauser that we've detected an incoming impeller wedge, inbound at just over 4,000 kPS, and accelerating at 190 gravities. She's about, what do you make the range, Wolfgang?
Call it 14.9 or light minutes, sir, Meller replied. She's just over 4 million kilometers inside the limit.
Append that information to your message comm.
Yes, sir.
Feynman shifted his eyes to the status board. At the moment, Leuchtfeuer was down for long overdue maintenance on her alpha nodes, but her sisters Heliograph and Semaphore, the designated ready-duty ships, were properly on station. Whoever this intruder was, they could at least give it a proper Volsung welcome.
Think they've seen us yet, sir?
Meller asked quietly, looking up at Feynman.
You tell me,
Feynman countered. Meller had promise, but he was also young and inexperienced. This would be a good exercise for him.
Yes, sir, Meller considered. Probably not.
Why?
Only 4 ships have hot nodes at the moment. Heliograph, Semaphore, and 2 of the freighters, Meller said. It would be very difficult for them to pick up anything other than an impeller wedge at that range.
Anything else? Feynman asked.
Well, it's not exactly scientific, Meller hedged. But if that's not one of our ships, they'd be crazy to head in system if they had any clue what was waiting for them here.
Good, Feynman complimented him. The kid definitely had promise.
All right.
If they're headed for a 0-0 with the planet, which looks likely from their projected vector, they'll hit turnover in another 160 minutes. By that time, they may be able to see more. If they don't turn around before then, they're pretty much committed to coming all the way into our parlor.
So if they break off before turnover, that'll mean they've definitely seen us?
Meller suggested.
Or they suddenly remembered they forgot to turn off the stove back home,
Thaman said.
And if they leave things too close to turnover, they'll still wind up in our range even if they then wise up and run for it.
Meller nodded. So no matter how it goes, they're in for an unpleasant surprise.
That they are.
Feynman made a face.
And speaking of unpleasantries.
Com, you'd better ask Captain Stoffel to join us on the bridge.
He leaned a little closer to Meller.
We're going to need him to sit on Hauser,
he added softly. The ATO nodded.
Yes, sir.
There was a reason Soren Hauser commanded Schmiede, an orbiting station well away from the pointy end of things. The base commander was an excellent logistician, a meticulous record keeper, and set a decent table for his fellow officers. But he wasn't the calmest and most methodical combat officer in the history of the galaxy. Still, Feynman thought as he looked back at the icon, just how calm and methodical did someone have to be to deal with a waddling duck?
Why aren't you bringing up your impellers?
Captain Soren Hauser demanded, his face starting to turn a familiar shade of red as it glared out from the comm screen on Tarantel's command deck. Schmiede's CO sounded distinctly nervous, Captain Dittmar Stoffel noted without any particular surprise. Feynman had been right about Hauser's probable reaction, although it was a bit hard for Stoffel to understand exactly how even he could panic over a single incoming cruiser. Especially one so stupid, or so pig-ignorant, that it clearly had no idea what it was accelerating into. Fortunately, Stoffel was senior to him, which meant Hauser was going to be denied the opportunity to screw this one up.
Because, Captain, he said, trying to sound as if he didn't consider Hauser a complete idiot. Our visitor is still an hour from his turnover point for a 0-0 with Prime. I'd prefer for him to get past that point before he figures out what he's poking his nose into. The closer he is to turnover, the less likely he'll be able to evade us when we move out in pursuit.
And if he gets close enough to fire off a couple of missiles?
Hauser demanded.
You may not realize how damned near naked Schmiede is.
Stoffel pursed his lips. There, at least, the other had a point. The base itself was completely unarmed. Its only defense was the pair of missile platforms floating in space over 1,000 kilometers away from it. And while those platforms were great at offensive fire, each mounted only a single counter-missile launcher and a single autocannon to defend both themselves and the base. And with no impeller wedges or sidewalls on either base or platforms, it was for damn sure none of them would be taking evasive action. So if the intruder decided to fire missiles at them, the chance that something would get through was a definite, even high, probability, assuming Tarantel and the other ships didn't prevent that from happening.
I understand, Stoffel soothed. Don't worry. Even if he comes all the way in, we'll be able to nail him long before he starts shooting. More likely, at some point, he'll realize he's bitten off more than he can chew, and then his full attention will be on getting his skin out in one piece.
I don't like it, Hauser rumbled. Why should somebody decide to come buzzing around out here, and especially when the Admiral's away?
Assuming any of his personnel survive, and I'm feeling generous, I'll at least give him the option of surrendering.
We'll ask them, Stoffel replied.
Whatever they're thinking, though, they obviously don't have a clue what they're facing. Even without Tarantel, we have more than enough mobile units to deal with a single cruiser.
Turn over in 3 minutes, ma'am,
Lieutenant Lukanov announced into the quiet of Casey's Bridge.
Very good, Clegg replied.
It was odd, Travis thought, how utterly calm the captain sounded. To some extent, she was like this during training exercises. But even there, he'd always been able to hear the tension bubbling below the surface. The hawk-eyed attention to detail that would get some hapless officer or tech a hot-to-icy reprimand in the after-action analysis. But there was none of that now. Not today. Not facing an exercise, but actual combat.
just as Travis himself had realized a TO's chair was where he was supposed to be. Perhaps the command chair was Captain Trina Clegg's designated place. She'd spent 3 decades of her life preparing to defend her Star Kingdom. Now, in this moment, all that training and experience was going to come together. Maybe this was a turning point in her own character. Or maybe she'd go back to being prickly once the shooting stopped. Unless they managed to get killed during it. Travis shook his head to himself. Now there was a cheerful thought.
Turn over in 30 seconds, ma'am, Woodburn reported.
Execute on profile, Clegg said with that same calm.
Aye, aye, ma'am. Executing now.
HMS Casey flipped end for end and began burning off her speed toward Walther Prime at the same 190 gravities.
And that, Captain Hauser, Captain Stoffel said quietly under his breath, is why I didn't bring up any wedges.
Thaman smiled tightly in agreement. He was actually a bit surprised the intruder hadn't already spotted Tarantel, despite the battlecruiser's inactive impeller nodes, with the range down to only 7.5 light minutes. But that was still over 135.9 million kilometers, he reminded himself. Quite a few things could get lost in the background noise at that range, especially with all of the emissions coming from Shmita. And if their sensor resolution was so bad they'd missed Tarantel, it was highly probable that they'd put the orbital station's missile platforms down to additional bases or simply orbital warehouses as well. Thaman smiled again. That should make Hauser happy.
About now, I think, Captain Ramos, Lynn said thoughtfully.
3 hours and 40 minutes had passed since Jensen's force had split up. During that time, Banshee's velocity had risen to 23,999 kps, and she traveled just over 158,397,400 kilometers towards Bergen II. In 33 minutes, Jensen was due to begin decelerating in his approach to the Danic shipbuilding platforms. It was time for Exodus.
Yes, sir, Ramos said. The programming's locked in on both the primary and the backup systems, and I've double-checked everything. The only thing I'm really worried about is the comm side. What if Jensen insists on talking to you? Those recordings aren't perfect, you know.
The computers will be up to the task, Lynn said. Worst case, he gets suspicious and pushes the button early, at which point Banshee does its magic trick and everybody on both sides wonders what the hell just happened. Not as neat and tidy as I'd like, but it would do the job.
Yes, sir, Ramos said.
He was still a little doubtful, Lynn knew. But there was no need for either doubt or worry. Axelrod believed in providing its operatives the best computer support available, and Lynn had taken full advantage of those capabilities during the voyage to Danic. He and Ramos had spent hours refining the list of keywords the software would look for in any incoming transmission. They'd spent even more hours providing the computer with pre-recorded responses, both audio and video. Unfortunately, those responses had to be fairly non-specific, which was where the fancy software came in, choosing which message to use in any given set of circumstances. In a pinch, the software could also manufacture its own CGI talking heads if the pre-recorded messages weren't adequate for the task. Lynn wasn't crazy about using the latter, mindful of its weaknesses. But in this case, he doubted anyone would have time to do the kind of scrub that would unmask it. Actually, Lynn was rather looking forward to having Jensen carry on a conversation with his computer doppelganger. After all, he'd been setting up for that the entire trip from Walther, making a habit of letting his attention apparently drift away during conversations, acting preoccupied and then suddenly jumping back in. Jensen had probably assumed he was doing that simply to annoy him. But what the Volsung believed didn't matter. The pattern had been established, and that was all Lynn cared about. A shame, really, that it had to end this way. It wasn't often that Lynn came across someone so easy to manipulate. Taking one last look around, Lynn picked up his mini-comp and the single briefcase racked beside his console.
Time to go, Captain, he gestured toward the hatch. After you.
Massengill's delaying tactics
with all the supposed miscommunication, lost orders, missing supervisor signatures, mislaid tether connectors, inexperienced platform crews, tug malfunctions, and enough official and long-winded apologies to fill a light cruiser, was over and had been successfully played. The three pirate heavy cruisers were docked at their respective platforms at Bergen III, and the boarding tunnels extended. No one aboard, as far as Massengill had been able to ascertain, suspected a thing. And then, completely unexpectedly, the whole plan started to unravel.
"That's ridiculous," Massengill said, staring at the displays. "That's what they're here for."
"I know," Major Bastange murmured over the comm. "I don't understand it either. All they said was that no one was getting aboard Molwitz and Burkersdorf until Ross Bach's commander had satisfied himself that the techs knew what they were doing and weren't going to screw anything up." Massengill ground her teeth, probably worried they'll get charged for extra breakage. Which made no sense at all. Just because one team didn't screw up or start stealing everything that wasn't nailed down didn't mean the next team wouldn't, no matter how long they made that team wait.
"Can you see the hatch?"
"Oh yeah, it's right there, straight down the tunnel ahead of us," Bastange confirmed.
"Sealed tight."
Massengill shifted her eyes to one of the other monitors. Theoretically, that meant Bastange could pull back until such time as the pirates graciously allowed them access, if he could get to Dorman's dock fast enough. But he couldn't. On Platform 3's monitor, she could see that Rossbach, or as Massengill knew her, Mamba, had already opened her hatch. Dorman and her three-man team were prepping their equipment cart and getting ready to head across the boarding tunnel. Even if Bastange or Danzer could magically teleport across Bergen III, the fact that Dorman's techs were suddenly being replaced by someone else was bound to raise eyebrows, questions, and suspicions. Bottom line was that Massengill's very best teams were going to have to sit on their hands while Dorman and her group walked into enemy territory alone. And if they screwed up, and the alarm was given to all three ships, the 303rd might lose two of its intended targets, maybe even all three. Massengill took a deep breath. Plan A had been sidetracked. On to Plan B.
"Sergeant Freytom, you copying all this?" she asked.
"Yes, Brigadier,"
Freytom confirmed, his voice muffled and oddly echoey inside his heavy assault armor.
"You want us to do a full breach?"
"Not yet, but be ready," Massengill said. "We'll give Dorman a chance first to beguile their way aboard Mamba and lock the hatch open for her assault team. But if that blips and the alarm goes up, I want you ready to charge in and try to open them up the hard way. You got that, Bastange?"
"Yes, ma'am," the Team One commander said. "You want me to call it, or will you?"
"I'll call it," Massengill said.
She was the only one with clear contact with Dorman and Team Three, which meant she would be the first to know if the balloon had gone up.
"Same instructions for you, Broussard," she added.
"Understood, ma'am,"
Danzer's heavy weapons attack leader confirmed.
"We'll be ready whenever you need us."
"Copy as well,"
Danzer said.
"Also, I'm seeing just one camera by Copperhead's hatch that's inside the tunnel. If we can blind that one, it'll give the breach team a few extra seconds before anyone inside knows what's happening."
"Same here,"
Bastange said.
"Give us a few seconds heads up, and we can take care of it."
"Understood,"
Massengill said. She would try to give them those seconds. She really would. Because the entire plan was suddenly on the tightrope here. Plan A had counted on the disguised tech squads getting aboard at the same time, and then being able to simultaneously lock the hatches open and let the armored full assault team swarm inside. Now, only Dorman's team would be able to follow that procedure. The catch was that once the alarm went up, Adder and Copperhead would still have a solid hull metal hatch between themselves and the commandos. In theory, they could probably breach the hatches within 90 seconds. But 90 seconds was enough time for a competent commander to figure out a good counter response. It was more than enough time for an incompetent one to panic. And for an armed ship with hot nodes tethered to a floating space dock, there were a lot of nasty forms a panic reaction could take. Dorman and her people were on the move now, rolling their cart down the tunnel.
"Good luck," Massengill murmured.
"All of you."
"Elsie Dorman,"
The head of Mamba's six-man reception committee growled out Dorman's name as he stared at her ID tag.
That's right,
Dorman confirmed, looking casually around the airlock area. There had been two cameras outside the hatch, one of them partially obscured by the boarding tunnel, but there was only one in here. And it was right below one of the floodlights the pirates had rigged up to point at the hatch. Mentally, she shook her head. No doubt they thought having a light they could shine in an attacker's eyes as he charged through the hatchway would be to their advantage. No doubt they also thought that putting their camera beneath it would help hide it from view. But with the light currently running at maybe half power, putting out just enough to illuminate the visitors, neither half of the ploy actually worked. In fact, in this instance, they'd have done better to shut the light down completely. She looked over at Corporal Rushkoff, currently standing stolidly for his own hard-eyed visual exam. She caught his eye, nodded microscopically toward the light and camera, got his confirming microscopic nod in return, and settled down to wait for the reception committee to finish with the other two jumpsuited members of their team.
Fine, the Mamba spokesman growled at last. Maybe he wasn't trying to be intimidating. Maybe that was just his normal voice. Two things. One, you keep your hands to yourselves. You don't mess with anything that doesn't have to do with missile launch systems. Two, we'll be with you every minute you're aboard to make sure you keep your hands to yourselves. Got that?
What?
Sorry, Rushkoff said, sounding a little confused as he lowered the hand he'd raised.
But I think that was actually 3 points.
For a moment, the pirate seemed at a loss for words. He looked back at his silent companions, then back at Rushkoff, then finally at Dorman.
Point four. Smart mouths get spaced. Got that?
Certainly, Dorman said with just the right degree of nervousness. We don't want trouble with representatives of the Andermani Empire.
A flicker crossed the pirate's face, as if he'd momentarily forgotten the role he was playing.
Right, he growled. Let's go.
You got that, Rushkoff?
Dorman interrupted, turning a two-barreled glare at the corporal.
Because I'm fed up with your games, too. And I swear that if they don't space you, I will.
Yeah, yeah, Rushkoff said, rolling his eyes.
Heard it before. So has my uncle. If you dare...
Dorman broke off, and for a long moment she and Rushkoff stared at each other. Dorman glaring, Rushkoff responding with smug innocence. Out of the corner of her eye, she saw the other two techs quietly moving the equipment cart off to the side of the hatchway, their attitude clearly that of innocent bystanders who wanted to keep it that way. Finally, with a muttered curse, Dorman turned back to the pirates.
Sorry, she muttered. Personnel problem.
So now are you ready?
The spokesman asked. Dorman had been wrong. His growly voice could also contain sarcasm.